Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you're a fan of NFL football, then you probably already know who Marshawn Lynch is. He's a legendary running back. He played for the Buffalo Bills for three seasons starting in 2007. He was traded to the Seattle Seahawks, where he stayed through 2015, making four Pro Bowls during that time, and he also helped his team win the 2014 Super Bowl over the Denver Broncos. He retired in 2015, but then he came back to play for the Oakland Raiders in 2017. And played for another two seasons. His nickname is Beast Mode because he could seemingly run through and overpower defenders, break through tackles for touchdown after touchdown. He's now the subject of a documentary, Lynch, A History, from filmmaker and best-selling author David Shields. Lynch sparked a lot of controversy throughout his career and famously did not have time or patience for the press. Here's a moment from the film that gives you an idea of how he interacted with or did not interact with the press.
I went to the San Francisco Zoo about 15 years ago, and I was standing there watching this big male silverback. And I looked into his eyes, and when I did that, he looked right back, like met my gaze.
So now for this next 3 minutes, I'll just be looking at y'all the way that y'all looking at me.
And it looked like he was formulating thoughts about me, about his surroundings. And right about then, I recalled this book of essays by Ralph Wiley called One Day When I Was on Exhibit.
Y'all got another minute to look at me, though.
And if you're a big, dark-skinned, black athletic man, that's pretty much what it is. You're on exhibit.
Then I'm finna sit here with my mouth closed.
And fans like to come up as close as they can to watch you in your natural habitat, so to speak. But what they fail to realize is that you can see them, you can hear them, and you formulate your own thoughts, and you reach your own conclusions about them.
Thank you.
That's from the film Lynch, A History, and filmmaker David Shields is with me now. He'll be showing the film in Iowa City on November 2nd as part of the Witching Hour Festival, followed by a discussion. Hello, David.
Hello.
Thank you.
Hello, Iowa City, yeah. My old stomping ground.
Thank you so much for being here today. And David, I mean, you live in Seattle now, so maybe I have a guess at this, but tell me what captured your attention with regards to Marshawn Lynch.
Right. Well, you guessed half of it. You know, that there's a boring part of me that's just a football fan. And, you know, I went to the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, you know, decades ago and was a huge fan of the Iowa football and basketball teams. And in fact, my first novel, a book called Heroes, was in many ways inspired by the University of Iowa basketball team from the 1980s. So 40 years ago, I wrote a novel about my experience as a basketball fan, as a graduate student at Iowa. And now here, 35 years later, I've made a film which, you know, came out of my experience living in Seattle and just on some level just being a fan of Marshawn Lynch's athletic prowess. But, you know, that's not all that interesting. And, you know, there's a million or thousands of great athletes. And I was terribly interested still am terribly interested in the way in which Marshawn Lynch uses silence as a form of defiance, protest, resistance that I felt the conversation around him was badly misguided, thinking he was either petulant or shy. And, you know, I knew there was more going on there, or I suspected there was, and I spent 4 years and $100,000 trying to prove my thesis correct.
Well, let's talk about who he is. Let's go back in time a little bit and talk about some of the forces that shaped him. He grew up in Oakland, California, right?
Right.
So tell me a little bit about that. Yeah.
I mean, that's really central to the film. I mean, it's among the sections of the film I like the most, is that, you know, it's sort of a cliche among people who write or film about Marshawn Lynch is to emphasize he's from Oakland, but I didn't really have any idea to what degree his you know, there's a whole amazing legacy of, to me, you know, powerfully effective troublemakers from Oakland, everyone from Jack London and Gertrude Stein to Alice Walker and Maxine Hong Kingston, you know, throughout Angela Davis, through Tupac Shakur, and, you know, Clint Eastwood went to Marshawn Lynch's high school, you know, the Black Panthers, the Oakland Raiders, the Hells Angels, the first African American Studies Department. I mean, in many ways, the Mexico City 1968 Olympics protest came out of the East Bay, and in many ways, of course, Colin Kaepernick's kneel down came in a way was partially inspired, I think, from Dr. Harry Edwards, who's based in the East Bay as well. So many ways, Marshawn Lynch is this profound product of Oakland, in which a lot of people from Oakland who always sort of feel like this kind of ugly stepchild to San Francisco and Berkeley, that there's a kind of figuring out a way to fight sort of class and racial warfare via sort of, you might say, undermining the discourse, not just protesting in the obvious way, but figuring out a way to be savvy about your resistance. I showed the film in L.A. A couple months ago, and there was an Oakland rapper who happened to be at the screening, and he said, no kid from Oakland would understand Marshawn Lynch's stiff arming of the media as anything else other than resistance to police inquisition. I thought that was such a great insight that, you know, that Marshawn's resistance to cultural media, to me, is not only this profound byproduct of Oakland, but carries unmistakable, to me, cultural and social and even political weight. And I think that kind of Oakland, what would you call it, you know, savviness, a sort of strategic misdirection, is something that it's at the heart of Marshawn Lynch's sort of verbal jujitsu, that, you know, like that, like those incredible moments when people say to him, you know, could you please explain that 67-yard run? And he says, thank you for asking. I mean, it's hard to know what to do with that, because on the surface, it's very polite, thank you for asking, but it couldn't be more aggressive and more hostile in its resistance to saying, I'm not going to speak in the idiom in which you're asking me to speak. I'm not going to translate myself. I'm not going to ask you to love me, and I'm not going to explain myself, you know, in a way that we've always expected artists, you know, whether Picasso or Faulkner or whoever, not to explain their art. And I think in a certain way that Marshawn Lynch comes out of kind of a deeply African-American tradition of that.
Marshawn Lynch was a standout athlete in high school, a four-sport athlete, not just a football star, but an all-around star in high school. We hear quite a bit from his high school coach in the film, giving us some insight into some of the things that Lynch overcame as a young man. He's very close to his mother, but his father's not in the picture, which his high school coach seems to think is a really important part of who Marshawn is and who he became.
I totally agree with, you know, with your good summary and with the coach Delton Edwards' insight. I mean, who's a crucial interviewee in the film, both interviews I conducted. And there's a wonderful line from Marshawn Lynch's mom in the film, Delisa, who says, don't talk about it, be about it. And that, you know, there's this really huge division in Marshawn Lynch between his mom, who I think, you know, said relatively little, but who was this absolute bedrock of Marshawn Lynch's life and still is, and his father, who is, you know, a drug addict, was in and out of jail, and was constantly conveying to Marshawn a lot of rhetorical reassurance that meant nothing. You know, that we'll spend the weekend together, you know, I'm there for you, and then he would always disappear. And I think it's just a profound division in Marshawn, and he talks about it throughout the film, you know, what's the value of me promising something to you or you promising something to me? You know, it's all about what the actual performance is, whether it's verbal performance or physical performance. So I think that, you know, in a way, you know, that he's just tries to be remarkably true to himself in this really impressive way. There's this wonderful line of Albert Camus who says, you know, the only way to deal with an unjust society is to be so absolutely free that your very existence is an act of rebellion. And I think in a strange way that he, or not a strange way, that in a powerful way, he kind of, you know, he tries to be free that in a capitalist racist society. He tries to be true to himself. And in that way, he's a pretty admirable citizen.
There's a moment in the film where he's asked to come up with a favorite memory from his college career, which is a really interesting moment because he doesn't talk about playing football. He talks about being signed to that team. That was such an interesting moment. What kind of insight do you get out of that?
He's very good at flipping your expectations. And I don't know, he's a really gifted performer that way. Like, you know, just around that same part in the film, the football telecast asks him what his favorite book is, you know, and he says Cat in the Hat, and that we do a lot in the movie showing that in some ways that might be a flippant or funny or goofy answer, but that we show how perfectly that book, that children's book, that, you know, that perfect children's book, Cat in the Hat, is first of all a map of our entire movie, and second of all, it's a pretty good insight into that, you know, the Cat in the Hat is the perfect trickster who basically undermines the world but remakes the world, you know, kind of gives the gift of play to the children in that short book.
We're going to take a short break. I'm talking with filmmaker and bestselling author David Shields. We're talking about his film Lynch, A History, which is about football player Marshawn Lynch. He'll be showing the film in Iowa City on November 2nd as part of the Witching Hour Festival, followed by a discussion. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour is David Shields. He is a filmmaker. He's also a best-selling author. And his most recent film is a documentary called Lynch, A History. It's about NFL star Marshawn Lynch. He played for the Buffalo Bills, the Seattle Seahawks. He also came out of retirement to play for the Oakland Raiders. And filmmaker David Shields will be in Iowa City on November 2nd as part of the Witching Hour Festival. He'll show the film and have a discussion with the audience. And David, before we talk more about Marshawn Lynch and his time in the NFL, I want to talk about your approach to this film, because it's a really unusual approach to a documentary. There's not an overarching narrative. So many of the things that we're talking about right now are not exactly laid out in the film, but it's a collection of clips juxtaposed against each other. So it tells a story. It shows us Marshawn Lynch, but it also definitely shows your perspective as the filmmaker. It guides us to see things how you want us to see them. Can you describe your approach for us?
Sure. Well, thanks again for watching the film so carefully and thinking about it carefully as well. I really appreciate your thoughts on it. What would you call it? Kind of literary or cinematic collage, or you could call it, you know, kind of what's called kind of found footage or a remix, you know, a repurposing. But essentially, I approached Marshawn and his representatives 4 years ago and said, you know, I'd like to make this movie essentially a love song to Marshawn Lynch and his use of silence as this sort of culturally potent, you know, a kind of silence as a form of eloquence. And, you know, they said, and throughout the next 4 years, they said, thank you, but no, that we won't participate, but we won't impede you either. So I was left with a couple of decisions. One, not make the movie, which was certainly a possibility. Two, kind of do that classic journalistic workaround in which one interviews everyone the person knows, but there's the sort of gaping hole in the movie, which is the person isn't speaking to you. And I also think that Marchand would probably have, you know, asked everybody that he knows not to speak. And then I kind of went to the way I've done a lot of the books I've done, which is this sort of transformation of found material. And so, you know, especially as a white professor, you know, I'm a full generation or more older than Marshawn Lynch, the last thing I wanted to do was to in any way speak for Marshawn. You know, the whole movie is about how his silence is a form of eloquence, and it's a resistance to white media, cultural, corporate narrative. So the last thing I wanted to do, frankly, was to impose a kind of Ken Burnsian omniscient voice on the film. So the film is 770 clips over 84 minutes. I think it's average about 7 seconds a clip. And so the movie runs at a very fast clip with, you know, emphasis on the word runs, you know, that we constantly toward ourselves, my film crew and I, that we always wanted the movie, first of all, not to feel like you're watching television. I don't think it ever sort of feels like you're just watching a sports documentary or a biopic or certainly an NFL game. And that above all, that we wanted it to feel as twisty as a Marshawn Lynch run, you know, that we wanted it to feel like sort of Beastquake 3.0, in which the movie stops and starts and stutters and reverses and surprises and has a rush forward, and it suddenly does a somersault, and it repeats itself. And that if the film works, then, you know, it won't be everyone's taste. It's not your father's sports documentary. Part of it, frankly, was that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, in the sense that, you know, this was the only approach that we could have given Marchand's decision not to directly participate. And so too, of course, because of fair use, that I could all, you know, I had my copyright lawyer on speed dial, who was constantly advising us how much of each clip that we could use. And so part of the reason the movie works at such a furious pace is that we wanted it to feel like a Marshawn Lynch run, but also, frankly, that we could only use very brief clips from all of our found material. So it's a kind of a marriage of a cinematic aesthetic and a legal imperative.
Let's talk about Marshawn Lynch's time in the NFL. He was drafted by the Buffalo Bills, and he spent 3 seasons there. And it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly in his career that while he is extraordinarily gifted and, you know, can really pull off seemingly impossible plays as a running back, he's not necessarily easy to fit into a team environment. Give me a little bit of insight on that.
Yeah, I think that captures it well. I mean, there's just something in him that, you know, he's not going to be, you know, as he would say, he's not going to be your boy. You know, he's just not going to be that guy, you know, who salutes to every time that you tell him, you know, to salute. And that, you know, the very opening of the movie is two people telling him to ask the reporter. He's only a 14-year-old kid in Oakland, and an Oakland Raider player and a African-American interviewer, you know, are telling him to ask the two of them a question, just some innocuous question, to be part of this little local TV broadcast. You know, it's just, it just ask us anything, you know, what's your exercise regimen, you know, what do you eat? And he just won't do what you tell him to do. And he just says, finally, I ain't got no questions. And it's just such a beautiful pushback You know, I don't know if you...
Well, and it, you know, looking at a 14-year-old, though, you can read that as shy. You can read that as awkward. You can read that as, you know, he's just really uncomfortable in that environment. And for a long time, that's really what people thought. But it turned out to be something more than that.
To me, the movie's almost main character is really Marshawn Lynch's Deepening Silence. To me, it was born in Oakland from a variety of sources. It was hugely deepened in Buffalo, and I would say darkened and kind of saddened by his understanding that the media was taking his words and his actions and, in his view, running it through a racial and racist prism. And then that silence kind of went viral in Seattle as he and the Seahawks became a nationally prominent team. And then for me, it got deeply politicized in Oakland vis-a-vis Donald Trump's election and Colin Kaepernick's kneeling. And then to me, that silence gets passed on as legacy to me to the next generation of younger Black athletes. I think in a really interesting way that Marshawn Lynch has taught, in my view, like a whole group of mainly Black athletes that there's a number of ways of protesting. And one is, you know, is running for office. One is retiring. One is protesting in the streets. One is campaigning. One signing a petition. But that one way of dismantling discourse is simply refusing to participate in a discourse that is shoving a particular narrative down your throat. So that, you know, that I think, yeah, that the whole Buffalo experience was absolutely central, in which he felt his words were being mangled and used as caricature of him as a, quote, thug, et cetera. And I think that is really when he doubled down on silence as a kind of brilliant strategy.
I'm talking with David Shields. He is the filmmaker behind the new film Lynch, A History, which is a documentary about NFL player Marshawn Lynch. He'll be showing the film in Iowa City on November 2nd. And I want to play another clip from the film, and then we'll go back. We'll talk a little bit about his time with the Seattle Seahawks as well. But he played for the Seahawks through 2015, and we'll talk about the end of his career with the Seahawks, of course, which is a moment that a lot of football fans and other people remember very clearly. So we'll tease that for a moment. But in 2017, he came out of retirement to play for the Oakland Raiders, and he sat during the national anthem in protest and in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick. And here's a moment from the film that addresses that moment in time.
And the spotlight is on Oakland Raider Marshawn Lynch.
High beast mode, Marshawn Lynch.
High Marshawn Lynch.
Marshawn Lynch.
High tech.
Raiders running back Marshawn Lynch has not stood for the national anthem since returning from retirement this season. But
high tech.
Before the game yesterday in Mexico City, Lynch stood for a different anthem.
High tech lynching.
It started Sunday when Raiders running back Marshawn Lynch sat down throughout the playing of the national anthem, but later stood up as the Mexican anthem played at the Patriots game in Mexico City. This morning, President Trump weighed in, tweeting, "Great disrespect. Next time, NFL should suspend him for a remainder of season. Attendance and ratings way down."
Herschel, when you saw heard about Marshawn taking a seat in Mexico City, what's your reaction?
I was insulted. I was insulted because I don't know whether he's taking this as a joke, which I think he is, because this is very serious.
Marshawn Lynch is one of the stupider members of the human race. He's a very, very dumb individual. And Marshawn Lynch, I mean, he's been famous for this for a long time. And before anybody says that this is something racial, I say that people are dumb cross-racially all the time. Marshawn Lynch is just, objectively speaking, a dum-dum.
A moment from the film Lynch, A History, and that was, of course, following many of those clips following when Marshawn Lynch came out of retirement to play for the Oakland Raiders and then sat during the national anthem in protest. And what were you hoping to show with that collection of clips? I mean, in so many ways, that seems like the culmination of Marshawn Lynch almost revealing what he's been trying to do all along.
Yeah, that's a nice way of saying it, that, you know, as you say, when he's a young man, a teenager in high school and college at Oakland Tech High School and at UC Berkeley for 3 years, you know, his silence is relatively muted. It might read as gentleness or shyness, or even sometimes as, you know, as willing participant in the conversation. And as we were saying, you know, in Buffalo, it gets considerably more dug in. And that, you know, basically, in a way, you could call the film, in a way, I think that Marshawn Lynch was always a political human being. I mean, you can't grow up, I think, as a black man, black kid, black person in Oakland, you know, was born in 86, you know, without just being surrounded by, you know, to me, just a deeply political and racially and class, you know, a class consciousness and a racial consciousness. But I think, as you say, that there's a sense in which the movie is about the politicization, the increasing politicization of Marshawn Lynch, that what had been perhaps subterranean and implied, you know, the movie's divided into five chapters, and almost chapter by chapter, that political consciousness gets more and more manifest, so that in the last chapter, you know, that Marshawn is literally wearing a T-shirt that says everybody against Trump, so that, you know, and he's not, I don't pretend that he's, you know, is running for Congress next week, or that he's only a political person. In many ways, he's kind of a savvy businessman, and above all, just, you know, a really talented sort of Hall of Fame level athlete. So, but that in a way, that's exactly it, that, you know, by the end of the film, what had been implicitly political becomes overtly political and political document by the end. And in a way, that Marshawn, you know, the movie is less about Marshawn Lynch per se, and more about, you know, how does any of us sort of figure out a way to coexist in this society? How do we carve out a little margin of expressive freedom for ourselves without sort of giving our entire spiritual being to capitalist system? And I think, you know, he's carved out, as I said, more freedom, more spiritual space for himself than most of us have.
We do need to talk about that Super Bowl in 2015. So the Seattle Seahawks won the Super Bowl in 2014, but they lost the Super Bowl in 2015. They are half a yard away from the touchdown line. And just giving the ball to Marshawn Lynch looks like it would have been an easy win. But instead, they choose to pass the ball. And of course, you know, there was a great uproar. Everybody talked about it. But in the film, you try to get us to look at that moment in a little bit different way. What do you want people to see there?
I mean, it's painful for you even to bring it up, because, I mean, when I showed the movie had its you know, its world premiere in Seattle on June 3rd, you know, and when I showed it at the Seattle Film Festival, you know, people were just, because in the movie, I show that play about maybe 15 times over and over and over and over again, and people just started booing, like they were just saying, you know, basically, please turn it off. We can't even watch it. So I try to give voice at that point in the movie to the idea that I think Pete Carroll wanted to prove himself to be a savvier coach than the famously savvy New England Patriots coach, Bill Belichick. He wanted to sort of surprise them. He wanted to show his own coaching genius. And I think one great point that Marshawn made just recently, maybe a month ago, you know, after the film has been made, is, you know, a lot of the players would have forgiven Pete Carroll, perhaps, and the coaching staff if they had owned the error. But instead of just owning it as a huge mistake, Carroll and the coaching staff sort of didn't take responsibility for, you know, among the more boneheaded decisions. And of course, it's easy to back form a 20-20. You know, if the play had gone right, of course, it would have been looked like a brilliant surprise move. Because there's this incredible moment in the movie where Marshawn walks past the coach, Pete Carroll, just after this horrible miscue, and Marshawn has this sort of devilish smile on his face, kind of like, told you so. and, you know, that we build that chapter with the opening epigraph is from Louis Armstrong, who says, "Nothing new, white folks still ahead." And I think that the movie tries to give voice to this idea that, you know, on some level, in Marshawn's view, the Seahawks wanted the more accommodating African-American quarterback to win the day rather than the angry black running back.
David, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
David Shields, he is a best-selling author and a filmmaker. His new film, Lynch, A History, about Marshawn Lynch, will be showing in Iowa City on November 2nd as part of the Witching Hour Festival, followed by a discussion. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Nearly 200,000 Iowans are members of the Latinx community. Miriam Alarcón Avila is part of that community. She immigrated to the United States from Mexico, and she moved to Iowa in 2002. She has created a photo project designed to raise the visibility of Iowa's Latinx community and to empower them along the way. It's called Luchadores, which translates roughly to invincible fighters or superheroes. The project received funding from the Iowa Arts Council, and her photos will be on display at Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City from November 18th through December 6th, and she is here with me now. Hello, Miriam.
Hello, Charity. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And Miriam, let's talk about your inspiration for this project. You moved to Iowa back in 2002, and you felt like looking at the Mexican Iowan community that people weren't very visible. Tell me more about what you saw or didn't see.
Well, back in 2002, I started work in as a baker. I moved here for education, but you always have to have a job to pay the bills. So I was working as a baker, and more Latinos I meet in the area, I start to realize they are all working in the kitchens. They are always behind the scenes. So when you go out and when you go to the art festivals, you don't see them. But I know they are here because I know them. And if you go to any restaurant, any single restaurant in Iowa City, and you pay a visit in the kitchen, you will see them. They are the ones cooking your food. They are the ones doing the dishes. They are the ones cleaning the places where you are enjoying and having fun. And they are there, invisible. So for me, it was very overwhelming to knowing that these people who have incredible stories are hiding and in the background where no one see them, and they live that life because it's really hard to be in the world when you are different. As soon as you speak, sometimes as soon as they see you, they know that you're different. But when you start to talk, they realize your accent is different. Your words are different. The way how you put your grammar is very different. And they start to mark you and put you in a tiny square. And that tiny square is just created from all these stories that we have in our heads, that we have from back in the history, like, oh, it's an immigrant. Oh, it's a Mexican.
Right, all those stereotypes.
Yeah, all that stereotypes. And knowing that they have these incredible, powerful stories, it just breaks my heart to see them hiding.
And there are many places in Iowa where there are thriving, rich Latinx communities where many immigrants from Mexico or from other countries will group together and feel comfortable with each other because, again, you are with people who have similar backgrounds and similarities and people who aren't going to mark you and put you in that little box. But part of this project and part of what you wanted to do is because there are communities within communities. We're not mixing.
That's correct. I keep saying that for inclusion is it's a two part. You as a Latino need to be integrated in the community, but the community also have to be integrated. I've been working really hard in the organizing, especially this past Latino festival here in Iowa City, because in the past it felt like, let's let the Latinos have their festival, their day, a day where they can just go and have fun and party between them, and that's it. But we've been working really hard to let the people know in the yes, we want to have that to celebrate all together, because we have this beautiful, rich culture, multicultural from all the different countries in Latin America, that is beautiful, musical, dancely, in all the different aspects. And we want to share it with the community. So integration comes from the two sides.
Let's talk about this project, the Luchadores Project. First of all, I gave the rough translation because if you type it into Google Translate, it tells you that Luchadores means fighters, but they're more than fighters. So tell me what it means to you.
So, well, I think that's the magic what I choose, the Luchadores Project. And the luchadores work because in Spanish, the word lucha, it has two meanings. The first one is the wrestling match in the lucha libre, in the Mexican lucha libre.
All right, so like professional wrestlers.
That's
with
correct.
The masks on, okay. Mm-hmm.
And the other one is overcoming and struggling, but overcoming. So it's that fight to overcome the struggle.
And
that is why I just think this is a beautiful metaphor to describe what the Latinos are doing in Iowa.
When you were growing up, you watched the Luchadores?
I did. And then, in fact, El Santo, one of the biggest lucha libre luchadores, was my superhero. My great superhero, he had this beautiful silver mask. And he make a lot of movies. I will say easily like about like 100 movies between 40s, 50s, 60s. So I watch all these black and white movies like El Santo against the vampires, El Santo against the mummies.
So he's like a professional wrestler, but he can take on all of these supernatural forces.
Yeah.
Okay.
And together with that, they always have... they do a lot of charity work. So a luchador wears their mask. El Santo wears his mask in his real life. Like when he died, he went to the tomb wearing his mask.
Oh, wow.
His identity was always covered. He never lose his masks. So it's a big metaphor of the Latinos here in Iowa to be wearing these masks and being superheroes, but covering their identity.
Well, and the idea came to you because you wanted to tell the story of immigrants to Iowa or members of the Latinx community, because, of course, not all of them are immigrants. Many, many of them have been born in Iowa and born in the United States. But you wanted to tell their stories, but people were reluctant to let you take their pictures?
Yeah, that's right. Like many years ago, I'm trying every time I hear someone like, oh, please let me take a photograph, tell me your story, make a video. But by the time when they was in front of the camera, they just froze and they say, wait a second, but they want to know, the people will know who I am. And I don't want people to know who I am. Because many of the stories are really hard. And part of this invisibility is the shield who has keep going.
Mm-hmm.
So despite of wanting and really wanting to share their stories, they are still afraid. We are afraid. Latino community, we're afraid.
So sharing the story makes you vulnerable, and also living in the political climate that we all live in right now, raising your head, raising your voice can make you a target.
Exactly.
So people were afraid. So when did you think, oh, I know, people will tell me their stories if I let them wear the masks of the luchadores? When did that come to you?
I was driving, and everything become like a domino effect, because I've been trying to do this project from a long time ago, but I didn't want to either like make their face blurry or darken it, because we are very underground and I don't want to keep it like that. We have to keep a lot of light and color. So I was driving, and then I was just thinking in El Santo, and I was thinking in his mask. Then I remember, oh my gosh, the mask. The superhero mask of the luchador. And the metaphor came to my brain, and it's like, this is the element that I can utilize to empower these Latinos and give them force to their stories.
So they can share their story, but it's almost like it's their superpower instead of the thing that makes them vulnerable.
Exactly.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
So when you started asking people if you could take their picture and share their story with the masks on, what did people say?
Some of the people kind of like, what? But then it's like, yes. So I think the other big part of the project is once I get the entire idea, I applied for the Iowa Arts Council grant projects, and I was so grateful to receive one of the grants. And that was kind of like the platform for like, okay, now I'm moving forward. And just having this big support is just give me the strength and the capability to like pursue the project and to continue. So every time when I meet a Latino and I'm talking about the project, everyone's in the Latino community know the luchadores, and I think despite that sometimes some of them are afraid, still afraid, by the time when they're wearing the mask, they realize like no one know who I am. So
when people see your work, the Luchadores Project, they'll see your photographs of people wearing these masks. How will you share the stories?
The stories I also share through a video. I'm doing like a video interview, so I have the video interviews for each one of the luchadores. But we also are writing poetry. So the photograph will come out with a poetry. And that poem, I was partnering with the Iowa Writers' House with Andrea. And Andrea Wilson, she came out with this incredible idea, like super easy idea, to be able to put their works in a poem form. So it was very easy for me to help them to write this poem. So basically we have like a questionnaire with about like more than 100 questions, and all about their experience as Latinos in Iowa, but also their experience in the immigration experience. So by the time when we ended up with these beautiful poems to share.
That's wonderful. So in talking to people about their stories, has that been difficult for you to hear all of these stories? Because while many of them, you know, have done very well, a lot of these stories are heart-wrenching. The things that would drive someone to leave home are really, really difficult.
It's been a very, very, very difficult experience for me. At the beginning of the project, I'm going to share a very short story just to give you an idea of what is the things that I'm listening. Mm-hmm. So I have a beautiful luchador. He is Lino, el luchador. He starts by saying, my immigration story starts in the womb of my mother. His parents was from El Salvador. He was a Salvador kid, baby, unborn baby. Mm-hmm. But his father was killed. So his mother had to run away when his sisters, and he born in Honduras. By eight, when he was 8 years old, he decided he need to help his mom and his sisters. So he decided to migrate and say, I'm going to go to United States and work and send money to my mom.
He was only 8 years old.
He was only 8 years old. So when I was hearing this story and hearing these, I have kids. Just imagine all the things that he passed walking from Honduras all the way to the border. When he finally reached the border, he was 14 years old. He passed for kidnapping. He passed for hunger, cold. And he overcome that. It was finally when he was 14 years old when he was able to call his mom. And being a mother, I cannot imagine thinking having an 8 year old boy somewhere in there.
Right. For 6 years, she didn't know.
Yeah. So he's now living here in Iowa. He's married. He have his kids. He is a great example of this story. So when I hear these stories, they just crush my heart, you know? And it make me thinking, like, I have to make sure their stories are portrayed in the best way possible, because they're inspiring. And I have to work in this one. It's compelling. I cannot stop it. I have to.
How many stories will you be sharing when the exhibit opens at Hanscher in November?
It will be 25 stories, 25 luchadores with their stories.
And are you still collecting more stories?
I'm still collecting more. In fact, some of my 25 luchadores, I'm still working on it. It's really hard to have a full-time job and another part-time job and being a mom and an artist. So.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I keep working.
And it feels like the artist part of you just cannot be denied. It would be easy, it sounds like, to say, I'm just going to work and make a living. But you can't stop making art, can you?
No, I can't. Sometimes I tell my kids, like, why I'm like this? Like, why can't I just be a normal mom where I have a job I don't have to worry about, go home and cook dinner and watch soap operas? I don't know.
No, because you are an artist.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like these are fascinating stories and beautiful, beautiful photographs. Yeah. And telling these stories is so important, Miriam. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Charity. Thank you.
We've been talking about the Luchadores Project, that translates to something like invisible fighters, and the masks worn by professional wrestlers in Mexico. And the stories of Iowa's Latinx community are being told through photographs of people wearing these beautiful masks, and also their stories being told through words, through videos, through poetry as well. It's the work of my guest today, Miriam Alarcón Avila, and it will be on display at Hanscher Auditorium in Iowa City, November 18th through December 6th. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.